Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 7th of September. Schools are starting, already have started in many parts of the country, but they're starting for sure today, the day after Labor Day. We're going to be talking about, well, I guess the overall question is, how do we determine whether a teacher is effective or not? This hour of the program, the Los Angeles Times created a bit of a stir recently. They produced an analysis of how effective Los Angeles Unified School District teachers have been at improving their students' performance on standardized tests. The Times decided to make the ratings available because they bear on the performance of public employees who provide an important service and in the belief that parents and the public have a right to the information. And people have been checking those performance statistics in huge numbers in Los Angeles. It's not just LA that's been using value-added modeling. Hundreds of school systems, including those in Chicago, New York, and Washington, are using it to measure the performance of schools or teachers. And there are expectations that more districts will go to this because the Obama administration has urged states and districts to develop more effective teacher evaluation systems than traditional classroom observation by administrators. We have two guests with us this hour, and we'll be welcoming what I'm sure will be many phone calls on the part of you, our listeners. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Two guests this hour, Jason Felch is a prize-winning investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He, of course, worked on this story, Value Added. In 2006, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Investigative Reporting for his coverage of self-dealing and looted antiquities at the John Paul Getty Museum. He's been awarded many other prizes, including the Science in Society Award for his series Genes as Evidence. He was a teacher for a couple of years. He was a fellow at the Center for Investigative Reporting and attended UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He founded an after-school program while he was teaching for immigrant teens based in San Francisco. And he is one of our guests this hour and worked extensively on this story, extensive story in the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Jason. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Professor Ed Hartle. He is Jack's Family Professor of Education and Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs at Stanford University. He is an expert in educational testing and assessment. His research centers on policy uses of achievement test data, the measurement of school learning, statistical issues in testing and accountability systems, and the impact of testing on curriculum and instruction. He has been very involved in the creation and maintenance of California's school accountability system and has served on advisory committees for other states. Professor Hartle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. Jason, let's start with you. Tell me about the origins of the idea for publishing all of these value-added scores and a little bit more about how you determine value-added.
In the course of doing some other reporting, a colleague and I discovered that essentially the school district had no idea who its best teachers were and who its worst teachers were. We were surprised by this and started looking around the country for who else, how other states and school districts evaluated their teachers. And we found that this was largely the case across the country, that teacher evaluations were haphazard, often very brief, based on very brief visits by a principal to a classroom once or twice a year, and then a subjective assessment of that. So we started looking around for other approaches and found that some states and school districts had been using something called value added, which is essentially a statistical analysis of standardized test scores. It was at that point that we thought that we might be able to do that type of analysis in Los Angeles, which has some of the best longitudinal data in the country, and that led to our request for, under the public records law, for 7 years of test score data linking Los Angeles students to their teachers.
And there must be a lot of teachers in LA, right?
There are about 40,000 teachers.
Oh my gosh!
In a local school district, and we requested data on 7 years of them. So yeah, there are a lot of teachers here.
You had a lot of work to do.
Well, we had a lot of help. There was a large team at the paper that was focused on processing this and analyzing it, and we had the help of an economist who we hired to help us run the statistical analysis of this data.
And these standardized tests, tell me what they are. Are they state tests? Are they what kind of tests?
Yeah, it's the in California, it's called the California Standards Test. It's given every year in May to every student from second grade up through 11th grade, and it's based on what the experts, the education experts, have determined are the key skills that students in each grade level need to know, and they test a sampling of those skills and use that to estimate how proficient students are.
And is that primarily in English and math, or does it go beyond that?
The annual test is only given in English and math. There are other tests given occasionally during other years. But the only data that we have for every year is English and math.
Mm-hmm. So you published these results, and there was a bit of an outcry.
There was a significant outcry, much of which we anticipated. The first to speak out was the teachers' union, which called for a boycott of the newspaper. We had a kind of a tidal wave of comments on our website, and what was fascinating was that they were all over the map in terms of their reaction to this. There was a lot of people who were deeply grateful for some type of objective information about local teachers. Parents in particular felt like we had done a great public service. A lot of teachers were not happy and were alarmed that we would be making this information public, were concerned about the reliability of the approach. And then you had reaction in the kind of education and academic community, too. So there's been a huge reaction to the stories, and it's been all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hartle from the academic community, what did you think of this story?
Actually, Jason and I talked in advance of the LA Times investigative report, and I think I was actually quoted at one point in one of the series of articles that came out in the Times around this issue. And as I told Jason when we talked, I'd be the last person to say that if an individual teacher's value-added scores consistently year after year are way above expectation or way below expectation, that the teacher and the principal shouldn't be made aware of that and think about it and talk about it and try to figure out what's going on, if anything, and what the explanations might be. But I was disappointed in the LA Times' decision to make these results public. As Jason said, there's lots and lots of teachers in LA Unified School District. The results that were published were only for a small fraction of those teachers, only those who are teaching in grades, 3 through 5?
That's right.
And the scores, as noted, are based only on reading and English language arts. The primary problem that I have with this, the primary concern that arises in the academic community, is that these results are really not statistically adequate to support causal inferences. That means we can't really attribute the test scores to the actions of the individual teachers. Everyone would like to have a way of teasing apart those influences on students' test scores that teachers should be held accountable for versus those influences on students' test scores that teachers really should not be held or cannot be held accountable for. Unfortunately, there's simply no statistical way to do that. We can't get a clean separation between those two kinds of influences. And value-added modeling has been oversold. If people believe that it gives them something it doesn't really give them.
Mm-hmm.
So the results are going to be inaccurate. For some individual cases, they're going to be grossly inaccurate. And we can't say for sure which cases those are. So it really does a disservice. I can go on, but maybe you'd like to... I don't want to go into
right.
a long monologue here. So
No, I appreciate your thoughts about this. You said that it was only grades 3, 4, and 5. Why didn't you go beyond that, Jason?
Well, two things. One is we're not done, and we plan to go beyond that soon. We're in the process of analyzing middle school data and hope by the end of the year to have data on high school teachers. But one of the limitations of value-added that everyone who understands it is aware of is that this is a tool that cannot be used to evaluate every teacher. Because the state test is only given in math and English every year, only teachers who teach math and English
yes.
can have a reliable year-to-year value-added score.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be less than half of the teachers in the district, even if it were perfect. In addition to that, to address some of the statistical concerns that Ed was referring to, we took a rather conservative approach of limiting our analysis to teachers who we had 60 students assigned to them and data for each of those students. So by contrast, in Washington, D.C., where value added is used as 50% of the evaluation for some teachers, they use 15 students. We chose to use a minimum of 60 students per teacher as the basis for their estimate. And the vast majority of our teachers have more than 100 students. Many have as many as 180 students that we use as the basis for our estimate. Mm-hmm. So there's still a robust debate in the academic community about the reliability of these estimates, as Ed alluded to, and we do not pretend that these are anything more than estimates based on a statistical sample. And it's an important debate that's going on about the reliability of this. But I think as you will find people with Ed's point of view, you will also find other preeminent statisticians who believe that this is a valuable tool. It needs to be used in the proper context and in conjunction with other measures, because it alone should not be used to evaluate teachers, but that it does provide some reliable information.
And it certainly is catching on. More and more states are using that. Do you believe, let me ask you, Professor Hartle, how much do you think a teacher should be evaluated on standardized test scores and whether or not they've gone up as a result of being in that person's classroom? Should that be a factor that is considered? Should it be 20% of an evaluation, nothing, 50%? What do you think?
That's a great question. What percent weight should you give to inaccurate information? I don't know that there's any percentage that I'm comfortable with, because I don't see any way to use data of this kind as part of a rigid formula that assigns points to different sources of information and comes up with some kind of composite score. As I say, the information should be looked at case by case in context and interpreted appropriately. I see at least three problems with the use of the evaluated scores for teacher evaluation. And I'd also, before I get to that, I'd say in passing that I don't think that publishing the scores of individual teachers on a website for the general public to search is, in fact, a use of these data with appropriate safeguards and in an appropriate context. But going back to the problems with using these data for teacher evaluation, the first is the simple fact of inaccuracy. Jason alluded to the unreliability of the scores, and in fact, because the LA Times analysis was based on 7 years of data, and as he says, a conservative approach in taking out teachers for whom the data might be less precise, the amount that the scores for teachers bounce around from year to year is probably damped down quite a bit. So reliability is one concern, and that's one that's been addressed as best can be addressed. A separate measurement concern, though, is accuracy or precision. If there's some systematic bias in these scores, using more years of data or using a larger number of students doesn't solve that. If every individual observation is tilted in one direction, looking across a lot of observations doesn't get rid of that tilt. And we have evidence that the results of this kind of analysis do, in fact, produce biased estimates, not just imprecise estimates in the sense of bouncing around. The second problem is that this use of value-added modeling is going to increase pressures just to teach narrowly to the test.
Mm.
We're already have a lot of pressures toward that, and the tests that are being used are pale reflections of what we really would like to see teachers accomplishing, even in mathematics and English language arts. There are problems with the California standards tests, as with the standardized tests in just about every state that have to do with the limitations on the formats that are used, the way in which the tests are constructed, how they align with the standards, the lack of articulation of standards across grade levels. I could go on about that. Then a second problem is that this this method sets up teachers to compete with one another for the students who are easiest to teach. In any school, teachers will know things about the students in that school that are going to affect which ones are likely to get high test scores and which ones low test scores. How that child's elder siblings did a few years back, whether there's a divorce in the family, a child's illness, all kinds of things that the teachers are going to know can't be incorporated into the statistical model. So you have a system that potentially is going to cause teachers to stop cooperating as a team and working in support of learning of all the children in the school, and instead are going to resent the children who can't score well and compete for the students likely to make them look good. That's a tragedy if that happens.
Jason, let's go to this the second thing that Professor Hartle was talking about, that as a result of publishing all of this in your series, there will be an increased pressure to teach to the test. Maybe that needs to happen. Maybe it is a true measure of making sure that our students do better in English and also in math to compete in this workplace. I'm sure we'll hear from teachers during the course of this hour who feel an incredible amount of pressure to follow a very narrow line of teaching. I've heard from teachers who have had to skip certain parts of history, like the Vietnam War, in order to fit in enough practice sessions for the tests that are coming in. Will this, do you think, not just in California, but this whole movement, value added all over the country, increase pressure to teach to the test?
It's a good question and a reasonable concern. I think at the everywhere where you see value added being used, it's being used in conjunction with other measures. And it's a really important point, because if value added were used in isolation, I think that would be a very reasonable concern and something that would be alarming. But no one's using it in isolation. And so, in a sense, the point of all those other multiple measures is to get at all the other things not covered by the math and English curriculum, and all the things that you can't pick up on a standardized test. And so when you see school districts make this 20 or 30 or 40% of the teacher's evaluation, it's those other things, the classroom observations, the portfolios of students, the surveys of parents. It's those other type of measures that will help balance out the value-added information and provide a complete picture of a teacher's. And teachers will understand that they can't merely teach the test and gain the system. The other point that I would make is that when we look at the most highly effective teachers that were identified through our analysis, these are not teachers who are, kind of robotically training their kids to master a state test. In fact, it's the exact opposite. These are teachers who value critical thinking, who are teaching a wide range of skills, and who are effective enough that they don't need to teach exclusively math and English in order to cover the material. The state test is geared towards the standards that the experts have said every kid should learn. So in a sense, teaching to the test is teaching to the required curriculum. But there's for effective teachers, they're able to cover that curriculum and a lot more during the school year, and they're not required. Now, will there be incentives to narrow the curriculum? There might be, but those should be balanced by the other evaluation tools that will be used in conjunction with this.
Let's welcome phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many of them. Our guest this hour, Jason Felch, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. Jason also has worked as a teacher, and he was a fellow at the Center for Investigative Reporting at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He's won all kinds of awards for reporting, investigative reporting. Also on our show this morning is Professor Ed Hartle. He is a professor of education and associate dean for faculty affairs at Stanford University. We're looking at this movement, which is spreading all over the country. The LA Times did an interesting thing here, which maybe other newspapers will do. They produced an analysis of how effective teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District are at improving their students' performance on standardized tests. They have made the ratings available because, as they say, they bear on the performance of public employees who provide an important service. Here's our phone number. Weigh in on the issue, 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. We have a ton of emails that have come in on this. You must be in the teacher's lounge. That's the only thing I can think of. But feel free to call us, too, with your thoughts about this. I'm sure we'll have more than a few. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Tuesday, we're going to be talking about and with, because we'll have two of them in our studios. I can't wait. Therapy dogs will be joining us, and we'll talk about that this second hour of our show. All right, our phone calls are flooding in, and we have tons of emails. Let us proceed to Rick from La Crosse. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Teaching colleges have known for years that some prospective student teachers are just naturally get better results with students than other people or prospective student teachers. And why can't they screen these people out while they're in college, the ones who are probably going to be a poor teacher?
Professor Hartle?
Well, some of that screening does happen. And yes, it certainly is the case that not everybody who starts into a pre-service teacher education program turns out to have what it takes to be an effective teacher. And some who are effective turn out not to like it very much. And the number of people who leave the teaching profession within the first few years after they begin is very high. So it's possible that teacher preparation programs could do a better job. I'm reluctant to make any sweeping generalizations because I know there's a great deal of diversity in the different programs. In addition, once teachers are out in the field, they almost always have a three-year probationary period. So during that initial period of time, there are opportunities for principals to evaluate the teachers and for in schools that have a robust system for building teacher community and assigning more senior teachers to serve as mentors for more junior teachers, there are opportunities to help these people improve as well. So some of that is going on. There are filters, and if those filters weren't in place, then the results would be even more distressing. It's not the case that everybody who starts automatically comes out the other end.
Mm-hmm. Jason, apart from this piece that you did on value added, what factors do you think go into making a really fine teacher as you look at your educational years and as you look at your most effective teachers? In addition to perhaps this, what should we be looking at to judge teachers?
What is kind of surprisingly something of a mystery, even to people in the academic field. With value added and other measures, we can begin to estimate who are our most effective teachers and who are not. But it doesn't answer a really important question, which is why are they effective? What are they doing that is setting them apart? And there are a lot of theories on this question by people far more expert than I who spend a lot of time observing teachers and looking at data. But for the time being, at least, there's still not a consensus on what the set of skills or talents or personality traits or what have you go into making our most effective teachers. What we saw, we spent weeks observing 50 different teachers on different parts of the district and comparing what we were seeing on the ground with what the data was saying. What we noticed was a few things. One, the highly effective teachers come in all stripes. They are not all doing the same thing. They are not all standing up on their desks. Some of them are soft-spoken. Some of them are very stern. Some of them are outgoing and gregarious. They come in all different flavors and sizes and types. And they're, by and large, all teaching the same curriculum. At least in Los Angeles, there are rather rigid curriculum standards, and they're usually using the same books, and they're often using the same pedagogical approaches that are dictated by the district. So on the one hand, you see a lot of sameness in terms of what they're actually doing, and on the other hand, you see this incredible variety of results. So it's something of a mystery. Why are teachers using the same curriculum, often teaching the same type of kids, getting dramatically different results? And it's not something that's an easy question to answer. I think we've certainly noticed trends, but I'm somewhat humble in my ability to answer this mystery. But one thing that we noticed, for example, is that, you know, the most effective teachers, you saw it not so much in what the teacher was doing, but in the reaction and the expression on the faces of the children in the room. So with effective teachers, the kids were very engaged and very actively engaged. You didn't see that with the ineffective teachers. But this is something that a lot of education researchers are spending a considerable energy trying to explain right now, and they're doing it in a variety of different ways.
Steve from Northern Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I have a question for your reporter. He said a few minutes ago that he does not take this data. In fact, he said no one takes this data apart from other factors in the classroom. My question is, by submitting this these data online, isn't his newspaper, in fact, endorsing that practice to simply take this information and do with it as you will? I'm concerned of, you know, a parent sitting at home and just simply reading this information and making assumptions about the teacher apart from conversations.
It's a fair question. I don't think we have done that, and I'll explain to you why. Both in the articles and on the website and in our Q&As and in everything we write and in every way we communicate this information, we make clear to readers this is not the sole measure of a teacher, and it should not be. It should be considered in conjunction with other information, and it has a certain amount of error in it. That means that it is not a precise measurement. It's more of an estimate. And with those caveats, we think that parents are able to use this information in conjunction with other pieces of information that they've always gotten. I mean, parents have always gone to school and talked with other parents about teachers and talked to principals and other teachers and kind of built a subjective view of who they wanted their child to be with during the day. This is to be added to that, not to replace it. And, you know, in California, for example, parents have an API score for a school. It is a data point based on standardized tests that is to be used in conjunction with other assessments. So we found that parents are able to put this data in context with other information that they have access to and to form kind of a more balanced judgment. We can't provide subjective analysis of all 6,000 teachers that we crunch the numbers for, but the people who can do that are the people who are on the ground, the principals, the fellow teachers, and the parents.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's give this email, the first one, to you, Professor Hartle from Cliff. The whole issue of teacher evaluation is complicated and controversial. As a teacher in the parochial school system, I often look at our system versus public schools. We have and will continue to have a back-to-the-basics approach to education. The majority of our students score well above the national average on achievement tests and are consistently on the honor rolls when they move on to high school. I think that the curriculum is a vital factor in determining student achievement in the classroom. They use Basel readers to teach reading. They teach spelling, grammar, and writing as separate subjects, not putting those together. And then he says, I feel our public schools would have better success rates if they adopted a back-to-basics approach.
Well, that's a thoughtful analysis, and it certainly is one. It's describing a sensible educational approach that certainly works for many children. It's difficult to make direct comparisons between results that a single parochial school might be achieving or even the parochial school system versus public schools for various reasons. There's a long history of comparisons like that, going back to Coleman, Hoffer, and Kilgore in the 1980s and before that. The basic problem is that the students who end up in parochial schools versus those in public schools may not be directly comparable. So there's no good way, again, to sort out the causal effect of a particular kind of educational approach versus the selection effects of the different students who end up assigned in a non-random way to one kind of school versus another. Curriculum certainly is essential, and I applaud the call for more attention to curriculum because it really is too often neglected in these discussions.
And we go next to Amy in Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hey. I want to applaud the research that's being done here in terms of just varying the way that teachers are being evaluated, and you know, value-added education being one of them. I'm wondering where this research will be available, you know, for other people to see. And then my question is, how does value-added education account for the fact that a student has one teacher in third grade and then a different teacher in fourth grade and may take the standardized test in fourth grade, and that one-year snapshot of that fourth-grade student might not account for, you know, teaching that occurred in third grade?
All right.
If I understood that, it would help me value added education better.
Thanks, Amy. Jason.
Could I speak to that also?
Yeah, sure. We'll start with Jason.
I will defer to Ed on the deep statistics, but in essence, the value-added approach looks at a student's performance over time. And so after a year with a given teacher, he takes a standardized test, he or she takes a standardized test, and you essentially compare the student's performance on that standardized test after a year with teacher X to the student's own performance after his, you know, a year with his prior teacher and several prior teachers if you have the data available. And so what you're trying to isolate is, and there's a debate about how successful it is at doing this, but the attempt of value added is to isolate the impact of the individual teachers and to control for all the differences among students that teachers are assigned by comparing a student to his own prior performance. So that's an attempt to say, you know, let's mask, in essence, the differences between poor students and rich students, students who maybe started the year behind versus, you know, were gifted, and try to focus on the growth, how much progress students are making, regardless of where they started, under an individual student, under an individual teacher, excuse me. So that's, in essence, what the value-added approach is trying to do.
Ed.
Actually, it's a good explanation, Jason. As I would expect, you, of course, are well familiar with the methods that are used in the LA Times analysis. The basic idea here is that, first of all, the fact that students are assigned to different teachers is absolutely essential for this method to have any hope of disentangling student effects versus teacher effects. Otherwise, if we have teacher A teaching students 1 through 30 and teacher B teaching students 31 through 60 and teacher C with students 61 through 90 and so on, there's no way that we can, if that's all we have, there's no way we can disentangle the student characteristics from the teacher characteristics. We rely on the mixing of students as the way of, in the statistical terminology, identifying the teacher effects. The notion here is that if I look at a student's prior year test score, the kid's score at the end of the previous spring, and I look only at children who have that same prior year test score, then within that group who had the same performance at the end of the previous year, those who do have higher scores this year must have received more effective instruction. There are a lot of problems with that. One problem is that the major problem is that the assignment of students to teachers is not random. We know that. There was a large analysis done by Jesse Rothstein using all the data from North Carolina and looking at the amount of gain that students made in their fourth graders, i.e. from end of third grade to end of fourth grade, and seeing whether he could predict those gains using the teachers that those students were assigned when they were fifth graders a year later. This is what's called a falsification test. Logically, there's no way the fifth grade teacher can influence the grade four gains. But what Rothstein found was that when you run the analysis backwards like that, it works just fine. You find large apparent effects of fifth-grade teachers on fourth-grade gains. So that's evidence right there that there's something wrong with these very strong and testable assumptions that are built into these models.
Let's go to another phone call. Lawrence in Marathon City. Hi.
Good morning. I attended school in the 50s and 60s, and at that time, it seemed like the teachers in the classroom, they were gods. Not the principal, not the superintendent of schools, not Arnold Duncan, and not the president of the United States. It appears to me that over the years, the tools have been removed from the teachers and have been given to the people above them. We didn't always like our teachers, but we worked hard, and we tried to do the best we could. a lot of people might think that your ideas are ludicrous, but I think the natural follow-up on this is in hard times, economic hard times, we could evaluate these students and assess their potential in the early grades and just extrapolate to later years right on through high school. In fact, we wouldn't even have to have any grades past third grade. We can do away with the teachers. We can do away with all those extra grades. And, in fact, we could save a lot of money for the property taxpayers. This is what I see your research being used for. I mean, it's ludicrous to think that you can assess statistically teachers' performance like this.
All right, Jason?
I'm not sure I follow the reader's gist, but I would encourage him to read. There's been a lot of research on these questions, and you know, there's reason for skepticism, but there's also reason for believing that these are really telling us something important, particularly when you're dealing with the highly effective teachers and the highly ineffective teachers. The data analysis that we did squared with the impressions of our most informed principals who are really paying attention to performance, to what parents think. So I think we came into this approach skeptical about the ability of this to make these kind of distinctions. And what we concluded after a year testing the data out in the field was that this is a powerful tool that should be used in conjunction with other tools. But to ignore the performance of students, to ignore the outcomes that a teacher has, and to base our assessments of teachers exclusively on the subjective opinion of a principal, to me doesn't make sense. And I don't think it makes sense to most people in this country.
And I think we forgot to answer one part of Amy's question, too. I'm sure that all of this information is accessible on the LA Times on the Internet, right?
Yeah, so our analysis is available on our website, www.latimes.com.
Okay.
There you can find, if you go /teachers, you can find all of our stories and our statistical paper explaining our methodology, the full database, and everything else like that. In terms of other states, this information is generally not publicly available, but that's something that may be changing soon. Everyone from the Secretary of Education to Randy Weingarten, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, one of the country's largest teachers unions, has gone on record in reaction to our stories saying that parents have a right to information about the quality of the teachers and that that information should be in some form made public.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The question of the hour is, how do we determine how effective our teachers are? And we're talking about publication of value-added. Well, it's a publication done by the Los Angeles Times, and they looked at how effective teachers were at improving their students' performance on standardized tests. This, of course, is something that's being looked at all over the country, actually. It's not just happening in Los Angeles, but value-added programs are in many, many cities in the country and may, in some ways, be a part of an administration drive to improve the effectiveness of teaching. There's some question about whether or not this is the most important way to improve the effectiveness of teaching. So that's what we're about this hour. More phone calls in a moment. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program is Tuesday. The puppies are here. They have arrived. We're going to be talking the next hour of the program about therapy dogs, and we will have the executive director of the Wisconsin Academy for Graduate Service Dogs, and his dog Ian will be with us, and Kathy Rust, who is a client of this program, WAGS, and her dog Ezra. So that's coming up hour number two. All right, let's go to Susan from Stoughton. Hello, Susan.
Yes, I'm a newly retired teacher, and I've taught special ed and grades 1 and 2 in my career, and I'm very excited. I wish I hadn't retired now that I hear this program, because I really think the value-added test is a great step forward. As a special ed teacher, I used value-added tests in that. I would test my child, each child, you know, in August when they came in, and then teach them again, test them again in June to see what they gained. And I don't see any other way to account for how a child makes progress or doesn't make progress. I think it's a great idea for all kids to have that. It's a great tool for teachers. When I was in first and second grade, I'd love to get my hands on the third grade test, reading test scores, and see how the kids that I remember in my class did, you know, in reading, because I kind of took a lot of pride in what I did in first and second grade in regard to reading. So I love the overall idea of bringing the value-added test to the entire school. It's a great tool for schools. They can tell how they're doing each year. Is their reading program as effective as the last year? If they make changes, was this a positive change as far as progress or not? And for the school district as well. However, as a teacher, I know that when standardized tests are being administered, many times there's a lot of cheating that goes on. I've walked into teachers' classrooms that were actually teaching the problems on the test before they handed it out to the students.
Ooh.
Yeah, and my question is, and in talking to other teachers, I'm not alone with that. Other teachers have experienced that as well. So while this, I think, is a great thing, this value-added testing, how do you control for just plain old cheating? Because when these ideas get put into place in the classroom, that's the kind of thing that happens. How do you control for that?
Professor Hartle, you want to start with this?
A couple of things to say, yes. First, very quickly, in another response to Amy's previous question about where to find more information, there was a policy brief released on August 27th by the Economic Policy Institute. If you go to www.epi.org and look at the link for 10 problems with the use of student test scores to evaluate teachers, you'll find a readable summary of much of the research that's addressed this question. Turning to this last caller's comments, the first thing that struck me is that she's talking about an individual teacher using value-added scores within a single year, testing in the fall and then testing again in the spring. Most of the large-scale implementations don't rely on fall-to-spring analyses. They rely on spring-to-spring. So you're going back to the previous year. We know from a lot of research that some children gain in their reading proficiency over the summer months and other children lose in reading proficiency over the summer months. So even students that started out or ended up the previous year at the same place are not starting the current school year at the same place, and that's one of the sources of bias and inaccuracy in these value-added scores. Turning to the problem of cheating, whenever it happens, of course, it's highly publicized and it's deeply troubling. And there are some methods of test preparation, like teaching the particular items that are going to be on next year's test, that simply are wrong and must be stopped, and we need to have strong protections in place to maintain the integrity of the system. We can use a few kinds of tools, like erasure analysis on bubble sheets, to find some cases of this, but basically we really need to rely on the integrity of teachers and school administrators to maintain the integrity of the scores. The design of the system can help if there's not a repetition of the same questions year after year. Test security is very important. And because of budget cuts, some state testing systems don't refresh the item pool as frequently or as extensively as would be ideal. But beyond just teaching the actual items on the test, that's the end point of a whole continuum of ways of preparing children to do better on tests. Including, for example, direct drill and practice on released items from previous years. Now, that may be not an unethical thing to do, but it may not be very good instruction. Really, the ultimate goal of schooling is not to get kids to be good at filling in bubbles on test sheets. It's getting them to be able to use skills, use their minds in important ways in other kinds of settings and for other reasons. But I applaud the caller's use of test data in a sensitive way and applaud her success with the students that she worked with. It's wonderful to hear.
Jason, do you want to respond to Susan's comments?
Yeah, I think the caller raises a good question. I mean, for in California at least, these tests have not had high stakes for individual teachers. The tests are mostly used to evaluate schools, and obviously those do come with some stakes. But I think if the stakes are increased, what school districts are going to have to do is pay attention to how these tests are proctored and to take that kind of thing far more seriously than is currently done. You're starting to see that in some school districts in California that are considering using this information. They understand that when new incentives are created, you need to put in new safeguards. So it's a reasonable concern and one that's being taken seriously.
Here's an email from Ben in Green Bay. I'm a grad student, social scientist, and this methodology sounds ridiculous. I understand the need for objective data, but this isn't it. The job of a teacher is to teach. A student is to learn. How can you study good teaching based on student learning? Can you assess a handgun manufacturer based on whether the consumer can shoot straight? Did you control for the value added to the student's education by good parenting versus bad parenting? Did you control for motivated versus unmotivated? Did you control for students that dislike their teachers and may perform worse on this test than they could have performed? Were students randomly assigned to the district? Were they randomly assigned to each classroom? And did you control for behavioral problems in individual classrooms? Jason.
In general, what this model is good at controlling for are factors in a child's life that are consistent year to year. So if a child comes from a poor community and has parents who are disengaged, most likely that was true last year and the year before and the year before that. And so when you're doing a value-added analysis, because you're looking over several years of that student's prior performance, the approach is fairly robust at controlling for those type of influences. What it can't do a very good job at controlling for is things that change in a given year. So let's say a student has a bad year because his parents got divorced, and that's really been troubling him. Well, then that student's performance could suffer that year, and it has nothing to do with the teacher. The way that value-added addresses this is by not basing a teacher's score on any single student. So we chose to have a minimum of 60 students, and so those single-year effects like that are hopefully, that noise is reduced, and what you hear above it is the clear signal of a teacher's performance over 60 different students, or indeed 180 students in many of our cases. Let me address a broader question, because
sure.
A lot of the debate about value added is it goes to its reliability, and I think the debate usually goes like this: how does value added compare to perfection? And is it perfect? And I think everybody agrees it's not perfect. I think the debate we should be having is, how does value added compare with the other tools on the table that we currently have to evaluate teachers by? And I think when you look at it in that light, which is the light that is kind of the most practical light, it's like, what are we going to use? If not value added, then what? What you see is that value added has been studied far more in depth and has been kicked around by the research community for a far longer time than many of these other measures that are being used to evaluate teachers. So the type of errors that exist with value-added are real, and there are limitations to it, but that is true of every method that we might use to evaluate teachers. And what we need to do is compare the relative strengths and weaknesses of these different measures that are out there and determine which mixture of them do we think gives us the best full picture. To merely compare value-added to some ideal of a perfect evaluation, I think, is unfair and doesn't advance the debate.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. Professor Hartle, if not value added, then?
There actually is a lot of work that's been done on the question of teacher evaluation. There's an old edition from the 80s and a revised edition of a handbook on teacher evaluation. There's a handbook of research on teaching that's over 1,000 pages long. It's an active field of research, and a lot is known, and there's also the research that goes into the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards, which is now run by ETS under contract to the National Board, which uses a system of teacher portfolios where the teacher constructs a portfolio documenting various aspects of teaching and is observed and so forth as a basis for evaluation of more experienced teachers. There are ways to train principals better to do a better job of observing teachers. If resources are provided, teacher peer mentoring programs can be very effective. There really is a range of possibilities.
Thank you so much, both of you, for this very, very informative hour. This could be the subject of a day's seminar, and I'd love every moment of it. Thank you. Interesting hour. Our thanks to Jason Felch, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, who is one of the co-authors of the piece on value-added teachers in the Los Angeles Unified School District System, Professor Ed Hartle, who is a professor of education and associate dean for faculty affairs at Stanford University. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return for another great conversation. So please stay with us. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.